From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Ali Soufan, CEO of the Soufan Group, an international strategic consulting firm in New York. This is a fortuitous moment because the unredacted version of Ali Soufan's best-selling book, The Black Banners, How Torture Derailed the War on Terror After 9/11, originally published in 2011, was just released last month. When the book was published almost a decade ago, large portions were redacted for what were claimed to be reasons of national security. But after a long fight mounted by Ali and his supporters, the Central Intelligence Agency finally lifted those redactions. We'll ask Ali Soufan the significance of this move by the CIA and why he argues that the use of intelligent and astute questioning is far more effective in obtaining actionable intelligence than the controversial use of enhanced interrogation techniques, otherwise known as torture. Ali is no stranger to these VOA microphones. We have interviewed him on numerous occasions on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly. We had the pleasure of discussing his other acclaimed book, The Anatomy of Terror, From the Death of Bin Laden to the Rise of the Islamic State, on Press Conference USA a couple of years ago. A native of Lebanon who immigrated to the United States and became an FBI special agent and top counterterrorism operative and interrogator, Ali Soufan served on the front lines against Al-Qaeda. He spent more than two decades investigating and analyzing Al-Qaeda and its offshoots. But he is witnessing and documenting another transnational threat, that of white nationalism or white supremacy. So in the run-up to a crucial U.S. presidential election in which U.S. President Donald Trump has minimized the threat by white supremacists, a statement which is at odds with the FBI and Homeland Security Department assessments, we'll talk with Ali about what he sees are the major domestic and international threats facing the United States and the world. Ali Soufan, welcome back to the program.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Carol.
And congratulations on the declassified version of the Black Banners.
Thank you. We're very happy that the truth is finally out. The truth of what happened after 9/11 and the truth about the alleged efficacy of torture now can be read in black and white. And that is a really major step towards more transparency and towards accountability, frankly.
Ali Soufan, first, even before we get into that, the declassified version of your book, Black Banners, you know, we always talk with you about your tremendous expertise in counterterrorism, but I'd like you to explain to our audience how you got into this business, you know, in the first place. Who is Ali Soufan, especially in light, again, of the publication of your book, in which you say that you told FBI Special Agent John O'Neill, who tragically died in the 9/11 attacks on U.S. soil, you said that he took you under his wing and asked you, you know, what motivated you, a young Lebanese immigrant, and I would add a fraternity brother, no less, at a college in rural Pennsylvania. What motivated you to apply to the vaunted FBI?
You know, I never thought in a million years I'd be an FBI agent or I'd work in national security. At one point, a couple of my fraternity brothers were applying for the FBI. They wanted to be FBI agents. So that was always their dream. And as a joke, I thought I'll apply with them just to see how long I will last in the process. And we had a bet how long, you know, it will take the FBI to basically tell me thanks, but no thanks. Interestingly enough, I was the only one who got in, and the joke was on me. I was found myself at the wrong place at the wrong time, or the right place, the right time, whatever you want to call it. And the rest is history.
And a very distinguished one at that. Speaking of your book, The Redacted Version of Black Banners, tell us what was revealed that was previously redacted by the CIA and the significance of the declassification.
Well, basically, anything that shows that torture did not work was redacted. There are lines where you will see, for example, the sentence starts and after sleep deprivation, and you see a lot of black lines, a lot of redactions. And you'll think, okay, you know, after sleep deprivation, that terror suspect said something or divulged national security threats. And now you can see that basically what was redacted, that after sleep deprivation, not a shred of information was given. That gives you an idea about the level of trying to cover up the alleged efficacy of torture or the false information about the efficacy of torture. You will see now how we get information that resulted in the disruption of the so-called dirty bomb or the plots against apartment buildings in the United States or the plots against Los Angeles or the alleged plot against the Brooklyn Bridge. A lot of these things heard about from people in high-level people in the Bush administration, to include the president themselves. And then now you will see exactly how we got the information, and you will see that all this information was obtained even before enhanced interrogation techniques and waterboarding were applied. So now the American public can see that the torture methods did not work. And they can actually know that what they are reading is the truth, because everything that was redacted in the Black Banners redacted on national security grounds. So when you redact somebody's account on national security ground, in a way you admit that it is the truth. I think, unfortunately, for those people who deceived the American public and they wanted to continue to deceive the American public, they never thought that we will fight for 9 years to make these redactions go away. And now, finally, the American public will hear the truth. And I have to take this opportunity to thank the leadership of the CIA for this act of institutional transparency that they allowed the truth to be out there for the American public and, frankly, the world to know.
Ali, I wonder, do you think that the FBI, particularly the CIA, rather, has taken these lessons to heart?
I hope so. I think, you know, remember, many of the people who were involved in this are not there anymore. They retired, and they are not part of the government. I think there is a new leadership. There are new folks in the U.S. government who basically saw what happened before, and now they can see the truth of what happened before. And hopefully, we won't repeat it. And that is the reason that I fought for all these years, because we needed transparency. Transparency is extremely important to have conversations based on truth. So we've seen what's going on today, unfortunately, in our political culture. We've seen that truth don't mean much anymore. The truth is an increasingly debased currency. And that did not just happen with this administration. That has been going on, frankly, for decades. You and I talked about a lot of these issues before. For example, false claims that Saddam Hussein was involved in 9/11, or Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction, and he was working with Al-Qaeda to attack American cities, lies that actually made it all the way to the UN Security Council, lies that enabled the Iraq War, lies that ultimately killed thousands of people, lies that gave a new life, a new blood for Al-Qaeda network that was dead after 9/11, and lies that eventually gave birth to ISIS. So it's extremely important to have these discussions, but we have it based on facts. And that's why it's important to talk about torture, because torture was one of these issues that became part of the cultural wars in America. Facts don't matter. It's all about, you know, raw emotions and partisan talking points. If you're with this political party, you'll be like, yeah, I'm for waterboarding, I'm for torture, it saved lives. If you're with this political party, no, waterboarding is bad and it did not save lives. We, as a democracy, it's important to have an exchange of opinions, an exchange of ideas, but we need to have it based on mutual understanding of truth. And now, let's read the truth about waterboarding. Let's see the truth about enhanced interrogation techniques. Let's read the truth about what happened after 9/11 and make our opinions based on these facts, not based on partisan talking points or alternative facts. And that's why I believe that on redaction of the Black Banners, I'm not aware of another book by a U.S. official that has been redacted and then unredacted again. That is why it's extremely essential and extremely important. And that's why I believe it could not have come at a more significant time.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest is Ali Soufan. He's a former supervisory FBI agent, acclaimed author, and CEO of the Soufan Group, an unredacted version of his best-selling book, The Black Banners, How Torture Derailed the War on Terror After 9/11, was released in September. And Ali joins us via Microsoft Teams from New York as we continue to socially distance due to the coronavirus pandemic. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Here's a shout out to a loyal listener and Facebook fan, Hassan Fisco Philip from Taraba State in northeastern Nigeria. Well, if you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send us an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our special guest, Ali Soufan. And Ali, before the break, we were talking about the need for truth and to try to not just condemn, but minimize the disinformation that is infecting our communication networks, whether via social media or otherwise. And in one of your excellent intel briefs, and I want to tell our audience that your center, the Soufan Center, produces these wonderful daily intel briefs that they can subscribe to on any number of important issues, domestic and international. And one of them was about America's domestic dysfunction and how it limits our ability to lead globally. And it relates to what you just said before the break, that some senior officials in the U.S. government have been sowing mistrust, even peddling in disinformation and conspiracy theories like QAnon and others, denigrating science, objectivity, empirical evidence. Unfortunately, President Trump downplayed the coronavirus and its threat, and unfortunately, he is a victim of it now. I'd like to get you to comment on how these trends are really inhibiting the United States from being the leader that the world really needs at this point.
This is sad, what we're seeing happening in our country. And I think one of the things that we have to keep in mind that the biggest threat the United States faces today is the threat that we are losing our global leadership. Many of our allies are kind of giving up on us, and many of our enemies and adversaries are taking advantage of the current dysfunction that we have and capitalizing on it. And sometimes they instigate it with campaigns of disinformations and foreign interventions. And we see the Chinese doing this. We see the Russians doing this. We see the Iranians, with even the Saudis. Many countries trying to interfere in U.S. politics and trying to create more wedges, social, political, and economic wedges in our society. And I think we need to pay attention to this. And we need to pay attention to these conspiracy theories that's dominating the political discourse today, both on the left and on the right. And I think the way that we can face that is with more transparency and with more accountability. We talked about one of the issues that was and continue to be a wedge issue in America, torture and Hays interrogation techniques. Now, I think when we see the truth about it and when we see the fact about it, hopefully people will start making decisions based on these facts. And when is the last time we have any accountability in anything? When is the last time we had accountability for any major things in American politics? Unfortunately, we are so into classifying everything, so into covering up everything. And that's what create more conspiracy theories and distrust in the system. And when you have more distrust in the system than trust in the institutions, you're opening the gates to conspiracy theorists and to basically foreign adversaries to wage their disinformation campaigns that's dividing us even further. I think we need to have more transparency in our system. We need to have more accountability in our system. And we need to prove to the American public, and we have to prove to the world, that our institutions can still be trusted and they will always speak the truth.
Ali, that leads me to ask you about our social media platforms, whether Facebook, Twitter, and so forth, and the penetration by many conspiracy theorists on these platforms. you certainly are more than aware about how Al-Qaeda and the so-called Islamic State and other international terrorist groups use these platforms to recruit followers and other agents. We just acknowledged this week that Facebook has finally decided, you know, after trying to limit the influence of QAnon, this very virulent conspiracy group, that after, you know, unsuccessfully for months trying to limit their influence, that they now have banned all QAnon groups and pages because they traffic in conspiracy theories. To what extent is this a good step? Is it sufficient?
It is a good step. I mean, QAnon, even though they are predominantly U.S.-focused right-wing conspiracy theory, they attracted a growing number of overseas supporters. I think back in July, Bison News documented the scope of the movement's spread. Now we have a QAnon festival in Finland. We have legions of followers from so many different countries, to include Canada, the United Kingdom, France, Germany, and even in places like Iran, in heaven's sake, and Japan and Russia. So their message has a spread. But it spread, Carol, due to a number of factors. So clever use of social media, proliferation of COVID-19 misinformation, and a lot of missteps by many of the tech companies, to include Facebook and Twitter and other platforms. So we have so many people, because of COVID, just sitting at home. The internet and being online is their line to the outside world. And a lot of these conspiracy groups supported and amplified a lot of times by foreign governments, by adversaries to the United States, are there to basically prey upon many citizens and giving them basically very simple and conspiratorial answers for their questions and further thoughts. So QAnon theories and the spin-offs by the Qs at this time became global, and it's not in the U.S. anymore. And it's about time that the social media companies take the responsibility and monitor their platforms and prevent these conspiracy theories, anti-Semitic groups, white supremacists, jihadis, whatever, you know, group we're talking about. This COVID-19, unfortunately, created a nexus between terrorism and disinformation. And it's like a buffet. There is something for everyone. Whatever your ideology is, whatever your hateful narrative is, there's something for you in the world of conspiracy theories and in the world of this nexus between disinformation and terrorism. And it's about time the social media platforms, all of them, are held accountable for this, because they are really killing democracy.
Yes, they're amplifying these theories. And I think, too, there's some responsibility on the part of consumers, those of us who consume news or use social media platforms. We need to be much more careful and critical about what we're reading and what we take seriously and not. And we need education. We just can't assume that people are using their critical faculties, but we must insist on that, especially when we're hearing from senior leaders that somehow the press is the enemy of the people. And of course, there's a good and bad press, but essentially it's a pillar of our democracy and it holds people in power to account.
Absolutely. You're 100% right, but that's why we have a problem today. We have a problem because more and more members of the public distrust the news networks, distrust the institutions. And this is because of a combination of the partisan talking points, the world of alternative facts that we live in, sometimes the promotion of these conspiracy theories and these basically groups like the QAnon by our leadership. A couple of months ago, we did an intel brief, and you talked about our intel brief earlier, about QAnon. And as of a few months ago, President Trump and his family retweeted QAnons more than 100 times. So this kind of normalizes this kind of conspiracy theories when it's coming from legitimate people. So we need to basically be more careful, and we need to basically call these things as they are. This is not a Democrat versus a Republic. This is basically people who believe democracy versus people who believe in anarchy, or people who are working knowingly or not knowingly, for the adversaries of the United States, Russia and China.
And Ali, you worked for the FBI. How does it make you feel when, for example, President Trump refuses to disavow QAnon because he says some of these groups like him? How does it feel when Mr. Trump refuses to condemn many of these fascist, anti-Islamic and misogynist groups like the Proud Boys, like he did in the debate? He seemingly encouraged them with a wink and a nod in the middle of an election. This tends to really undermine our FBI and other national security law enforcement agencies.
Not only our FBI, even this week, DHS put a report that by every metric, white supremacy extremism is the biggest terrorism threat to the United States. They basically made it clear that 2019 was the worst year for domestic terrorism since the Oklahoma City bombing. White supremacy is a problem in the United States, and it's not because we articulated that long time ago, early on. We've been talking about that. But today, now, the U.S. government started to see it our way, too. So you have, for example, the DHS. We have the FBI. We have the FBI director testifying last week in Congress about these issues. We have State Department, for the first time in history, declaring and designating a white supremacist group as a terrorist organization. So the Trump administration, early on, with the national security strategy drafted by General McMaster, mentioned white supremacy and neo-Nazi organizations as a national security threat to the United States. So everyone in his own administration, everyone in the U.S. government, from State Department to Department of Homeland Security to the FBI to the Department of Justice to state and local groups, acknowledge that white supremacy and hate groups are basically major terrorism threat to the U.S. And unfortunately, we've seen what we've seen during the last debate, where the president seemed to be lost of words when he was asked to condemn them, and he instead said, stand down and stand by. This is very dangerous. There's a big difference between politics and between national security, and it is an amazing scene what we've seen during the debate, that the president of the United States is playing politics with a very significant national security threat by refusing to condemn white supremacy when he was asked to do so by Wallace.
And Ali, very briefly, he often, as does Attorney General Bill Barr, blames Antifa, says quickly, forget about that, the white supremacists. What about Antifa? They're the real problem. What do you say to that? And first of all, Antifa is, as former Vice President Biden said, is really not one group, it's a movement. But define it briefly and say, you know, what evidence is there to show for that?
Let me respond with this by telling you what FBI Director Chris Wray recently said in Congress when he was questioned about the threat of Antifa by members of Congress. He basically said, and I quote, it's not a group or an organization, it's a movement or an ideology. So white supremacy, we have groups. We have Adam Waffen. We have the base. We have RIM. We have RAM. We have the Proud Boys. We have a lot of these groups that put racially motivated messages out there. But Antifa is an ideology. Anarchists, they like to break windows and put graffitis and sometimes throw Molotov cocktails. And these are criminal acts, but these are not terrorist acts. And what the vice president answered during the debate is exactly what the U.S. government is saying. It's exactly what his own administration, President Trump's administration, is saying. And it's exactly what his own FBI director testified to in Congress.
Indeed. And of course, it's very important to underscore that there is no relationship between Antifa groups and the Democratic Party. In fact, I think Antifa would say far from that. They're against all forms of capitalism. And
they hate everyone.
Exactly. But as close, Ali, I want to talk about something very important about another intel brief, your excellent intel briefs. And I use them very often in my programs, by the way. I cite them because I learn a lot and they're very useful. the 911 nation. And that speaks to the terrible police brutality that became very evident and overt after the death of George Floyd at the hands of Minneapolis police. And we've had protests all summer, and those continue because there's something amiss with our police forces. There seems to be an emphasis or a jump to use violence and force as opposed to community policing and other different mindsets that could prevent violence, could prevent crimes, and tamp down these terrible incidents. I'd like you to speak to that, because I think it probably relates to the lessons that you were explaining in the book, The Black Banners, about how torture is really not a way to get actionable intelligence. It's using guile, it's using intelligence, it's using other means. How can that be applied to our police forces in this country? What can be done to reform and improve them?
Look, you know what? The police mentality in the United States should be protect and serve your neighbor. That's it. That's why we have police force. Unfortunately, more recently, if you start looking at police departments, they look like a paramilitary group. They look like an army. And I think mentality need to change a little bit. We need to focus more on community relations. And I can tell you that the greatest majority, almost every police officer in the United States, good people who are there for the right reasons, who are there to protect their neighbors, who are there to protect their community. But unfortunately, when you have some bad apples doing some bad things and you try to cover up for these bad apples and the bad things that they are doing, that's going to create significant damage in the trust between the community and between the police force. The police force, without the support of community, cannot accomplish the security and safety of the neighborhood and vice versa. So I think what we need to do is we need to basically change our mentality, both as communities in the United States, the way we view law enforcement, and also some law enforcement departments, how they view the communities. And this is extremely important because towards the end, police officers every day put their life on the line for our protection. But also in the same time, I think we have communities in the United States that at this point have no trust whatsoever in the police force. And I think we need to build these bridges again, because the police is to protect and serve the community, and the community also should have enough trust that this is exactly what the police force are doing. And you're right. Many communities don't feel that there's transparencies in investigating some of the alleged actions by police. Many communities, they believe that there is no accountability for some of the actions of members of the police force. And this is creating the division that we have today and we see in American cities across the nation. I think it's important to take a step back and to work on building these bridges between the law enforcement and the community, because law enforcement has to be part of the community, has to be trusted to be part of the community. And in order to do so, they have to have enough transparency and accountability to make the community trust them.
Absolutely. But also they need help. As you say in your excellent intel brief, people just can't call 911, which is the number we call in the United States if we have problems. But it's become a catch-all. By cutting social welfare programs and access to mental health resources here in the United States, that has led directly to an increase in these calls that police simply can't always attend to in the best way.
It's the same thing that we've seen in Afghanistan and Iraq. We send the military, and then we trust the military to do the jobs of diplomats, to do the job of law enforcement, to do the job of aid workers, to do the jobs of building nations. That's not what they do. The military is not there to do all these things. The military is there to create a secure environment so the diplomats, so the aid workers, so other entities in government can help to facilitate peaceful transition and a better future for that specific country. And that's exactly what's happening here. We keep cutting and cutting programs and social programs and aid, and then we start having problems and poverties. We blame everything on police. We say, you know, law enforcement, you handle it. That's not how it works.
Absolutely. And in addition to that, like you said earlier, we do need to change across the board the warrior mindset to a more protect and serve your neighbor mindset. So a lot of challenges remaining for reform in police here in America. Ali Soufan is a former supervisory FBI agent, CEO of the Sufan Group and author most recently of the declassified version of his original bestseller, The Black Banners, How Torture Derailed the War on Terror After 9/11. Ali Sufan, thanks again, as always, for your terrific insights.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate being with you, Carol. Hopefully next time we'll see you face to face.
Yes, I look forward to that. For now, Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe and Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.